It was me, just me and my older brother for a while till the brats came along. And when they did, Mom and Dad would often take them and leave me and Mike by ourselves. Mike's a year older than I am. He's 58. That's when we would do stuff that resulted in calamity. You're familiar with some of those times because I preached here long enough. We ran the tractor in the pond. You know that story. We shot a screwdriver through the kitchen floor with a PVC pipe and an M80. Remember that? Remember me putting on my puffy Bengals coat? Remember those coats, Derek, the big puffy ones that made you feel like the Michelin Man? And we shot each other with BB guns in the dark, and you just stand there like a superhero because it didn't hurt, just until you saw the coat in the light and you realized you'd done a really bad thing. And then one day, he left us, and I don't know how it was at your house, but at my house, my dad, when he would punish us, it wasn't enough that he just took his belt off. He had to give us a story before the hurting came. And he's been a preacher for most of my life. He would put his story in the form of a parable. The parables were worse than the punishment. They were. He left me and Mike alone one day, and I can distinctly remember, and I loved it. He said to Mike, who was only a year older, son, you are in charge of him. And when I come back, if anything has happened or gone wrong, I will hold you responsible. Well, I looked at that as a green light to do anything I wanted to do. Even at that age, I could figure, well, he's going to take the brunt of this. So while they're gone, we had a dog named Boomer. He was named after a football player. And he was the jumpiest dog you've ever seen in your life. And we'd hold stuff up and say, Boomer. And he'd try to jump up and get it. So we thought, what a cool idea it would be. And I don't know how this stuff originates in your head to think it's a good idea. But we took some hamburger patties out of the refrigerator, and we were just little guys, and we stuck them to the ceiling tile in the kitchen. And if you've ever wondered if hamburger will stick to ceiling tile, it will. I'm here to tell you it will. And we put Boomer on the table, and we tried to see if he could touch the ceiling with the hamburger up there. And it was hard never to get the hamburger, and we thought, what a great thing this was, until we took the hamburger off the ceiling. I mean, it came off, but it left hamburger patty rings all over the tile. So then we thought we need to wash that off. Well, we tried to wash it off. All that did was turn the rings into a big smudge, and we both knew we are in serious trouble when he gets home. So he comes home, and Mike immediately tells him that it was my idea, and he needs to come and look at the ceiling. And he looks at the ceiling, and he says, in the other room, boys, and we know what that means. We had a room, we called it the piano room, and it had some guitars and piano in there, And that's where Dad would go into his parables. So he marched us in the other room. And my dad, when he would go into his parables, all of a sudden he would put his preacher voice on. And he would fold his arms behind his back, and he would pace in front of us. Boys, there was a man who had two sons. And that man went on a journey, and he left the older son in charge of the younger son. And he comes home to find hamburger patty rings on his kitchen ceiling. What do you suppose should happen next? Well, I spoke up, and I said, as surely as the Lord lives, the older brother must die. Jesus gave us 40 parables. A parable is a timeless story that reveals supernatural principles about heaven and the kingdom of God. A parable is a story within a story. In Matthew, the 13th chapter, there's an interesting comment, and I love this, about Jesus. Jesus spoke in parables to share things hidden since the creation of the world. Do you know what that means? He's telling us the secrets of heaven with his storytelling. For those who might be tempted to think our preacher tells too many stories, I point you to my mentor, Jesus Christ, who told more stories than any preacher I have ever heard before. And the one he told in Luke chapter 11 is one of my favorites. It's called a twin parable. It does have a twin 7 chapters later in Luke 18. I don't want to talk about the twin. The twin is a widow who goes before a judge, and she keeps going and asking the judge the same thing over and over until he finally gives in and listens to her. That's the twin. But let's look at this baby in Luke 11, 5 through 10, and then I'll tell it in my own words. Jesus said to them, suppose you have a friend and you go to him at midnight and say, friend, lend me 3 loaves of bread. A friend of mine on a journey has come to me and I have no food to offer him. And suppose the one inside answers, don't bother me. Door's already locked. My children and I are in bed. I can't get up and give you anything. I tell you, even though he will not get up and give you the bread because of friendship, Yet because of your shameless audacity, he will surely get up and give you as much as you need. So I say to you, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives. The one who seeks finds. The one who knocks, the door will be opened. Here's the story. How simple, how profound. There's a man who lived in Israel years ago, had a friend come to his house at midnight. 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 No phone, no fax, no postal service, and also no food in the house. Now, in the Middle East, hospitality was considered a must. So much so that when the Apostle Paul gave us a list of characteristics of an elder, do you know that one of those characteristics was he must be given to what? Hospitality. So, it's important that this guy takes care of his guest. So he goes down the road to his buddy's house. He says, I'll go and I'll ask for bread. I think it was W.C. Fields who said, a friend in need is a pest. So the man hurries out into the darkness, comes to the door of his friend's house. It's midnight. He knows everybody's asleep, but he starts pounding on the door. And he shouts, I need some bread. I need some bread. I got a guest. Get out of your bed and give me some bread. And a voice on the inside yells out what you would yell out if I knocked on your door at midnight and asked for bread. Go away. Go away. We're all asleep. Kids in bed with me. Go away. Door's locked. I can't get up. Now, in Israel, homes were generally one room, and the door was not locked with one of those little builder's square fix-it locks. It was a big beam that went down into a stone and a chain cage. It was quite an ordeal just to unlock the door. So the guy inside was like, go away. No bread, no way, no how, no sir, go home. What part of no don't you understand? And this is where we separate winners from losers. Man pounds on the door again, louder and longer. I need bread. 3 loaves of bread. A friend is coming. I've got nothing to feed him. Get out of that bed and give me some bread. The man inside, dude, go away. Too late. I'll wake up my children as if they're not awake yet. My wife will be on my case for 3.5 weeks. Go away. Come back tomorrow. I'll give you some bread. Persistent man. I'm driving that bird crazy, ain't I? I hope it's annoying to you all because that's the point. Hey! Get out of bed. Give me some bread. All of a sudden, he hears the thud of bare feet hitting the floor. The door is unlocked, and 3 loaves of bread are put in his hands. Bible doesn't say it, but I imagine 3 loaves of bread are thrown out the door at him. But now he can go home and feed his friend because the man got out of bed and gave him the bread. A good way to figure out what a parable is talking about is to make sure you know what it's not talking about. Here's the common interpretation by many in the religious world, and I reject it completely. See what you think. You bang on the doors of heaven. You ask your friends to pester God too. Sooner or later, you'll wear him down and wrestle a blessing out of his tightly clenched fist. What do you think about that? I'm glad you all are with me. That interpretation doesn't sound quite right because it's not quite right. That would lead you to the conclusion God is reluctant to help his children. We don't believe that, do we, church? We don't believe that. I have a word for that interpretation. I think it comes from the Hebrew. The word is hogwash. And for you King James folk, that's hoggeth washeth. Parables are told to reveal spiritual truth. But watch this. Not all parts of a parable have specific counterparts. This is where we get in trouble. For instance, some do, some don't. Prodigal son. Who's the father in the prodigal son? Talk to me. I heard it. Say it. God. God is the father and the prodigal son. God's not the father behind the door in this bed. Not every character has a spiritual counterpart. And I can prove that it's not God who's behind this door because God never sleeps. The Bible tells us that. This man was. Secondly, this man said, don't bother me. And the Lord's never bothered by my request. And thirdly, the man said, I can't get up and give you anything. Well, we know the Lord can do all things. So don't try to match everything from a parable up to some kind of spiritual counterpart. The parable is not about the characters. It's about one truth. One truth. If we ask God and never give up, he will provide. That's the lesson behind this parable. So I want to approach it three ways, three angles. Prioritize it, persist in it, plan for it. let's talk about priorities first. What if God showed up here this morning, and I believe his spirit is with us, but he looked you in the eyeball and he said, what's the most important thing in your life right now? And you know you can't lie or fudge it because he will know whether you're telling the truth or not. Listen, if you could ask God for anything and you were assured it would be yours, what would you ask for? My contention has always been if you ask for the thing that's most important, you're in business because God has already proven he's willing to provide that. My grandpa Bub would always say the recipe for rabbit stew always begins the same way. First, you have to catch the rabbit. There are all kinds of priority verses in the Bible. Here's a few of my favorites. Seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. All these things will be added to you. Whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please God. For me to live is Christ, to die is gain. You shall have no other gods before me. When this man came and knocked on his neighbor's door at midnight, he only had one thought. He wasn't there to have a midnight chat. He wasn't there to collect money that the neighbor had borrowed. He wasn't there to ask how the kids are doing. He was only there for one reason. Hey, bread. Get out of the bed. Give me some bread. I can't speak for you, but I figure I'm normal in some ways, and I'm often feeling the need for a priority inventory in my own life because, golly, I get so caught up in things that, honestly, they're important, but in eternal perspective, I let a whole lot of things slide that matter a whole lot more than the things I give my attention and my time to. I get it backwards. I'm like the woman sitting next to an empty seat in Rupp Arena watching the Kentucky Wildcats play Florida for the SEC championship. Wildcat fans, they are rabid. And a man asked her about the empty seat. She said, well, it was my husband's seat, but he died. And the man said, I'm sorry, but I'm surprised another relative or friend didn't jump at the chance to take the seat. She said, I don't understand it either, but they all decided to go to the funeral instead. John and Sarah's dream was to have a child. For John, it would be icing on the cake if they had a son who could wrestle in the yard, play ball, do the things he saw other dads doing with their sons. And the Lord blessed John and Sarah with a baby boy. His name was Johnny. He was their pride and joy. He began to grow, and once they passed a house that had one of those baby pools in the yard, and he said, I want one like that, Dad. And Sarah told John she was going to get him one, and John said, no, you don't want to do that. Those pools will kill the grass. So we've worked too hard on that lawn. It's looking nice, and I don't want to kill it now. And Sarah said, honey, the grass will come back. It always comes back. Johnny was really growing, and when he was about six, he told his mom and dad, I want a sandbox. And John said, where are we going to put it? And Sarah said, over in the corner of the yard. And John said, come on, Sarah. All that work we did, sandbox, is going to kill the grass. The neighbors won't like it. I don't want one. And Sarah again said, honey, it's grass. Grass will come back. Johnny was growing, had lots of friends at school, and every Saturday they'd come home and play baseball in the yard. They played so much that they began to war paths where the bases were, and John didn't like it. He came home from work one day and he complained to Sarah, why can't they play in somebody else's yard? They're here every week. They're killing the grass. Sarah, what is it with you and the grass? The grass always comes back. Johnny was a sophomore in high school and became a pretty good basketball player and wanted to put a hoop up. Only place was in the yard. He knew better than to ask his dad. So he asked his mom, and she said, sure, go ahead. Johnny and his friends played about three times a week. John came home, noticed a bare spot developing, and he got upset with Sarah. I told you this was going to happen. She said, please stop. Grass will come back. It's been 2 years since Johnny was taken in that bad car wreck. And John stares out the window of the kitchen, and he sees his beautiful yard, more beautiful than it's ever been. Tears stream down his face, and he says to himself, Sarah was right. Look at the grass. It came back, always comes back. And now all John could think was, I just want Johnny to come back. I had a teacher years ago who gave the same counsel to every class she had, and we got the message, don't let the urgent take the place of the important in your life. happens on a regular basis. It happens to me, happens to the church. It's all about focus and priority. I wonder if the Lord came here today and said to me and said to you, I'm doing an audit on your life. I want to see your calendar, your day planner, and I want to see your checkbook. And I want to see how many times I'm mentioned. I want to see how many times I'm referred to. I want to see how many times I'm thought of, because I want to know what's most important in your life. Don't let the urgent take place of the important in your life. Several years ago, I went to the airport, and I was hustling. And they tell you to be there like 2 or 3 hours early, especially right after 9/11. They pulled an old lady in front of me to the side and ran that scanner wand thing. She had to be 93 years old. Are you serious? Got these big thugs walking through, and they pull her aside. And I happened to be just in the right place, and I'm glad that I was, because as soon as I walked by, I heard her say, if I miss my flight, I'm going to kill somebody. So maybe they had the right idea with that lady. But the guy in front of me a few years ago had a bottle of Visine, about the size of my thumb. And the guy in front of him, with a badge on one shoulder and a chip on the other shoulder, wouldn't let him go. This security guy told him, you can't take that on the plane. A bottle of Visine. Because he said, and I quote, it's a threat to national security. I love how all your heads went, just like that. So did mine. Can't take that on a plane. It's a threat to national security. A bottle of Visine. So they began to argue. And I'm afraid I'm going to miss my flight. And I'm listening to the argument, though, because I love it when people argue. I will turn on an argument on TV as quick as I'll turn on a ball game. Something about it appeals to me. And so here they go. I have a prescription. Well, let me see your prescription. Well, I don't have it on me. Well, you can't take it on the plane. Well, I need to take it. My eyes freeze. I got to have my Visine, and back and forth. About 5 minutes. And finally, the guy with the badge and the chip says, well, if you'll step over here, we have some baggies. If you put it in the baggie, then you can take it on the plane. Shouldn't that have been brought up about 5 minutes ago? So then my mind starts wondering, what in the world? What if it was the most explosive substance known to man in that little bottle? What's the baggie going to do? I mean, at 30,000 feet, is it just going to go poof? All those people saying, thank God for that little baggie. What in the world? Listen, it's so easy for us to lose focus on what matters most. Somebody snuck in while we were asleep and switched the price tags on everything. And the end result? We're more concerned about what our kids wear than we are where they are in the relationship with the Lord. We have got our schedule so tight, the things we end up leaving out are church-related events. And we somehow justify that because we're too busy. We've got our finances so tight, the things we end up leaving out are the things with eternal consequences. We've given our kids a terrible example to follow because we buy things we don't really need with money we don't really have to impress people we don't really like. And the question the Lord has for all of us this morning could be phrased this way. In your life, what are the things that matter most? To this man in Jesus' parable, it was a matter of priority. It didn't matter what else was going on. He's just there because he needs bread. Identify what it is. Prioritize it. And then persist in it. I love the Bible examples of persistence. Jacob wrestled with an angel of God till daybreak, and he even said, I'm not going to let you go until you bless me. Daniel prayed intensely for 21 days for God to send an answer from heaven. 21 days. Esther had all of Israel pray and fast for 3 days and 3 nights before she went in to see the king. In the upper room in the book of Acts, 10 days, consecutive days of prayer, and as a result, they left the room, turned the world upside down. Listen, I'm sure many of you have felt like you've hung in there, you've held on, you've been faithful, and you see nothing happening. My advice to you is keep it up. Keep it up. Square your shoulders, lift your head, have confidence in the Lord. Keep on praying, keep on serving, keep on expecting, keep on knocking, because you don't know when the master of the house is going to get out of bed and give you the bread that you need. Persistence doesn't hesitate. It doesn't look over its shoulder at yesterday's mistakes. It doesn't play the role of the victim. It doesn't say, I'm the way I am because of the way my parents were when I was young. Persistence is a divine fire that burns in your soul that hell and high water can't put out. Jesus said he who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is not fit for service in the kingdom of God. Persistence is like wrestling a gorilla. You don't quit when you get tired. You quit when the gorilla gets tired. Paul, after being whipped over and over and stoned and left for dead and walking in chains, after all of that said, we are more than conquerors through Christ who loved us. After all of that, he said, if God is for us, who can be against us? After all of that, he said, greater is he that's in me than he that's in the world. So I don't know about you, church, but I'm a child of God. I believe in Jesus. I've surrendered to him. I've been filled with his spirit. I'm guided by his word. I'm led by his hand. I'm not going to give up. I'm not going to throw in the towel. I'm not going to take a dive. I'm not going to go down for the count. God has always come through for me, and he will come through again. I ain't leaving here without the bread. Persist, prioritize, and then plan for it. I want to be careful here before I close, because I've always preached, and I firmly believe it, it's biblical, that attitude is choice. So if you have a bad attitude, I don't think it's fair for us to sum it up and say, well, that's just their disposition. Seems like a cop-out to me, biblically speaking. Because you can choose to be how you want to be. But while I say that, there is something to this, well, that's just his nature. There are grouchy people who I think it's probably just their nature. There are happy people. I mean, you can overcome that, but I think it's probably fair to say, well, that's just their nature. Do you know why we can expect answers from God? Because it's his nature to give gifts to his children. It's why I have confidence. It's God's nature to want me to ask and then to want to respond. It's what he does. It's who he is. You ever been in a position to have to borrow money from someone and you knew it's not their nature to pay me back? Or it's not their nature to give me the loan in the first place. They'll say no. And you're a little disappointed, but you're not surprised, because you'll say, well, that's just their nature. Well, I have a sneaky suspicion that when we see each other in heaven and we're talking about all the beauty of all this stuff, and we as a church family can say, man, remember when we talked about this? And this doesn't look exactly like we were taught. It's just going to be so cool. And the Lord may stroll into our circle and go, what'd you expect? What'd you expect? It's who I am. It's what I do. It's my nature. Some of you were at a dessert meeting a couple of weeks ago that we held. I'm going to close the same way I closed that meeting out, so you've heard this, but all of you who were there, I know you pretty well. You could hear it again and still not get it. Are you with me? So I'll close the same way. And I didn't put the figures on the screen for you at that dessert, and I will this morning. I've often thought about Moses, because it's like he's the preacher of the church, and people just complain to him all the time, even though he's led them out of slavery and he's done everything that he could. They're just never happy. And then I think about the logistics of that many people. Moses led 2 to 3 million people out of Egypt. Mind-boggling to me. Do you know what that would require? These are conservative estimates. 1,500 tons of food each day, and to bring that much food, it would take 2 freight trains each a mile long. Firewood for cooking, 4,000 tons of wood a day, and they were in transit for 40 years. Water to drink, cook, and wash, 11 million gallons each day. A freight train with tank cars 3 miles long just to bring water. And here's my favorite thought. They needed to get across the Red Sea in one night, according to the Bible. If they went on a narrow path, double file, 2 by 2, the line would be 800 miles long and require 35 days and nights to get through the Red Sea. And they had livestock. So there had to be a space in the Red Sea 3 miles wide so they could walk 5,000 abreast to get across in one night. And just to camp out at night, they would need a campground 2/3 the size of Rhode Island, a total area of 750 square miles. Now, here's my question, and it's a serious question. Do you think Moses had any of that figured out before he marched those people out of Egypt? Yes or no? Let me hear it. I'm glad you didn't say yes. I would argue with you in church right now. Of course he didn't. And you might be tempted to think, well, I'm not Moses, Mark, and you're certainly not Moses. That's for sure. God hasn't changed. I don't know what this church is going to look like in 10 years. I don't. I try to have vision, look ahead. I don't know what ministry in that new building is going to look like. I don't know exactly how it all gets paid for and done and where that leaves us years from now. But you know who does know? And I'm planning on that. God knows. I'm planning on that. Years ago, when my cousin Merle took his own life, 1 week after graduating from Purdue, 3 weeks before he was going to get married, broke our hearts. I wrote a song for his funeral. And the day of the funeral, I couldn't sing, obviously. It was too emotional. I should have known. So I read the lyrics. I don't know that I've sung this song since then either, because I wrote it for that day. I remember the tune, and I'm not going to sing it to you, but I want you to hear what I wrote before his funeral. I may not get my answer today. I may not get my answer my way. I may not know anymore tonight. I may never see my answer in sight. But I'll keep on asking because the Lord told me to. And I'll keep on trusting because it's the one thing I can do. And somehow I know in my heart it's okay because God gives me his attention every time I pray. Here I am again, Lord. You know what I'm going to say. I've said it many times before. I said it yesterday. I know your help is coming. I've seen it time and time again. It's never been a matter of can you do it. It's only a matter of when. I don't know about you, church, but because of the nature of God, here's the thing I'm counting on, and I always will. I'm not leaving here. I'm not leaving here without the bread. Amen?